today on Against the Grain. What should we expect blacks to do? Blacks suffering from and outraged by police violence. Juliet Hooker wonders whether a black politics of nonviolence and respectability makes sense given the status of African Americans as consistent losers in U.S. democracy. I'm C.S. The University of Texas-based political theorist joins us, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. When Black Lives Matter and other protesters demonstrate against police violence, how should they conduct themselves? If the protests become less than civil, if they turn violent, what should the rest of us think and believe? Is it appropriate to condemn the protesters for not following the lead of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., for not taking the path of nonviolent civil disobedience, which, we've been told, changed the minds of white onlookers, spurring and shaming many of them to renounce racial oppression? According to Juliet Hooker, blacks have been condemned to be perpetual losers in U.S. democracy. And she questions whether it's fair to expect African Americans to peacefully and nonviolently acquiesce to this democratic loss. Juliet Hooker is Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity. In a paper Juliet Hooker presented at a recent academic conference, she wrote that African Americans are experiencing a defining moment of racial terror in the U.S. in the 21st century. When Juliet joined me from a studio on the UT Austin campus, I asked her what she meant by that statement.
Well, there's been in the past couple of years a number of very highly visible incidents, the death of Trayvon Martin, through the killing of Michael Brown, through the choking of Eric Garner, through the killing of Tamir Rice, just event after event where the killing of unarmed black men, boys, women, children have just been repeatedly brought to the attention of not just blacks, but the community at large. And I think it's a defining moment of racial terror because, like the moments in the 1930s, for example, when you had widespread lynching, there's a sense in which the availability of video, for example, is making these moments capable of being grasped in a really immediate way. And what you see is unarmed, fleeing black people, not resisting, being shot with over-the-top number of bullets, just being essentially what seems like gunned down in various ways. And so I think it's a defining moment of racial terror because of the, you know, there's this sense of immediacy, the repetition, the sense that you've only just gotten over the, you know, horror of watching one video and then another one appears. And it's this constant bombardment and reminder that there isn't safety. And I think for, especially for black citizens, it's a reminder that this could be them, right? When President Obama said of Trayvon Martin, that could have been me, it's when you see these videos, you are not looking at them as an outsider, but seeing them as I could be walking down the street, or I could talk back to a police officer, or my wife could, or my son could, or my daughter could, and something like this could happen. So I think it is a moment of very dramatic and real racial terror.
Why do you think not much has changed, and I'm assuming this based on what you just said, why do you think not much has changed in terms of police violence against African Americans since the protests that followed the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson?
I think that a couple of things have happened. I think one of those things has been that while there was a lot of outrage and a lot of sympathy for the protesters in Ferguson and for what had happened, and a lot of outrage at the killing of Michael Brown, there were also many people who looked at that, you know, that case and came to the conclusion that it was justified. and who came to the defense of the police and who blamed the protesters for their behavior, who accused them of looting, etc. And so I think that not a lot has changed, because in part what has happened is that instead of looking at this horrible event where, you know, Michael Brown is murdered, there is a sense in which people looked at it and instead some came to the defense of Darren Wilson or thought that he acted in a way that was justified. Others have taken the position that the police are the ones under siege, even though they're the ones who keep in incident after incident being caught lying, for example, about why they used unnecessary force against various Black people. And I think that part of what has happened is that even though there's been a lot of mobilization, there has also been backlash. And so there have been, I think, some important moments, such as the fact that there was, you know, some officers have been indicted, but it's taken an enormous amount of protest and an enormous amount of mobilization even for that to happen, as in the case of the Laquan McDonald indictment in Chicago, for example.
How much empathy or concern do people in the U.S., and we're speaking generally here, have for and about the suffering of Blacks, in your opinion?
So I think one of the issues that, one of the reasons that we haven't seen, you know, a change in response to these ongoing acts of police violence is that a lot of citizens who look at these incidents tend not to identify with the victim. They tend to instead, right, put themselves in the position of the police officer. And we know, for example, that Darren Wilson, for example, had this narrative about how Michael Brown kept coming towards him and was this sort of superhuman figure, that they bring to mind these notions of, you know, sort of Blacks as criminals, as these kind of superhuman figures. And so I think a lot of, frankly, whites listening to these stories can put themselves in the position of being afraid of Black people, of seeing them as potential threats. And so it means that they have a difficult time then displaying the same kind of concern and empathy for Black pain, for the suffering of the people who are the victims of violence, and even seeing them as victims. And I think this is the effect of something that I call racialized solidarity, that we tend to think about, or we tend to have a hard time displaying empathy or care and concern, which is what solidarity is and what we're supposed to have towards our fellow citizens, for people who don't look like us. Right, we see them as different, and so we don't see ourselves as having the same kinds of obligations towards them. And so I think that that is part of what is going on in terms of the lack of empathy that we see, or the rush to blame the victim. So that even in the case of, you know, a 12-year-old like Tamir Rice, there are people who are trying to find, you know, a past that they can point to as why he was an undeserving victim.
So in other words, do you think there is an assumption that comes readily to many whites that the African Americans involved in these incidents are actually criminals and therefore deserving of, or at least undeserving of, normal protections?
I think so. I mean, I think part of what's happening is that I think we need to think about these incidents of police violence not as sort of singular, but in the context of a larger trend of mass incarceration, right, where people have even described U.S. society as a carceral society. And mass incarceration has disproportionately affected Black and Latino populations. And so there is a way in which in a society defined by mass incarceration, where Blacks are disproportionately imprisoned and, you know, caught up in the criminal justice system, there's already a presumption, I think, that they are either already criminals or soon to be criminals. So there's a way in which that facilitates, you know, the way in which for example, people who are protesting police violence then can get criminalized or called thugs simply because they're protesting, because there's already this perception that, right, well, a lot of Black people are thugs, which quite easily bleeds over into, well, most people or all Black people are thugs or something of the sort. And so I think that when we look at this question of why is it so difficult to really see the problem of police violence, I think it's intimately bound up with this question of mass incarceration and this notion that particularly Blacks are already criminalized.
Juliet Hooker joins us on Against the Grain. She's Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And she's the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity. We are talking about a paper she recently presented in San Francisco at the American Political Science Association annual meeting. It's entitled Ferguson, Baltimore, Democratic Suffering and Black Sacrifice, Riots as a Form of Democratic Repair. And suffering and loss, I mean, this describes what's happening to African Americans and the Black community in the face of police brutality. I'd like to ask you about what the political theorist Danielle Allen has written about the role of loss in democratic politics.
So one of the very insightful ideas that Allen explores is this notion that democracies are, or the experience of democracy, of being a citizen in a democracy, is defined by loss. And this is because citizens have different policy preferences. And inevitably, in a democracy where the majority, right, wins in any kind of policy debates, that means that there are winners and losers. That means that there's some people whose preferences get enacted and others who don't. And so while we think that democracy is about, right, participation and getting your agenda enacted, it's also about having the opposite happen, right, about not seeing that happen. So that she argues that, right, this experience of loss, of having to cope with losing an argument, is something that all citizens experience, and that therefore democracies have to find ways to cope with the experience of loss.
Cope with the experience of loss. And what happens in Allen's mind when some parts of a society lose more? They lose systematically. There is a disproportionate balance between winners and losers.
So one of the things that she points to the 1960s, and she argues that up until that point in the United States, what you had was that losses weren't equally distributed, right? That one group, you know, essentially got the task of winning and another got the task of being good losers. And the good losers were African Americans who weren't allowed to participate in politics, who were barred from equal employment opportunities, et cetera, who were operating under Jim Crow racial segregation. So one of the things that is key then to this idea of loss is that in a democracy, it's supposed to be arbitrarily distributed, right? There shouldn't be one systematic group that is always the one that loses a debate, that loses in terms of a policy decision, because the experience then of having to sacrifice, right, to have to peacefully accept that you lost, is one that all groups need to experience in order for it to be legitimate. Otherwise, what you have is an uneven democracy where certain groups are always expected to be the ones who peacefully accept their losses and who sacrifice by peacefully accepting rather than revolting. And I think one of the things that I talk about in the paper is that I don't think that this stopped happening in the 1960s. I think we continue to have a pattern by which Blacks or African Americans are democratic losers, are the ones who are expected to cope with and to make sacrifices on behalf of U.S. democracy.
The novelist and literary critic Ralph Ellison, he had some strong opinions about whether African Americans should peacefully accept their losses. What did he write? What did he think?
Ellison is very interesting on this point. He comes to talk about this issue of democratic sacrifice in the context of a critique of the philosopher Hannah Arendt's, her critique actually of the Black parents and of the NAACP, whom she saw as pushing for school desegregation and putting school children, you know, African-American young children in harm's way or exposing them to social rejection. And so she penned this very famous, infamous essay, Reflections on Little Rock, and Ellison, responding to her, argues that she missed the way in which actually these battles for school desegregation, in which African Americans essentially put their bodies on the line and expose themselves to, you know, to white rage for the sake of greater equality, were these moments of heroic sacrifice. And he argues that, you know, African Americans in the South had to learn to give up the desire for retaliation or revenge, not just because, you know, they could be killed or because they were subject to sort of arbitrary racial violence, but also, he argues, because they had a duty to themselves and to the community to heroically accept those losses and sacrifice the need for revenge.
So he thought that if Blacks responded to racial terror with violence of their own, then their lives, the African-American lives, would be endangered, would be further endangered. What did he think about what peaceful acquiescence on the part of Blacks would do to whites' inclination to support the cause of racial justice?
I think he thought that it would impel people, particularly white citizens, who would, you know, be able to see this heroic sacrifice, to then sympathize with the struggle of African Americans for racial equality, and that it would therefore lead to a kind of transformation in their support for racial justice.
Right, and here we are talking about nonviolent protest. I mean, it's not that Ellison just said African Americans shouldn't do anything. He did support nonviolent activism as a way of trying to transform society.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what he was trying to suggest against critiques like Arendt's is precisely that, you know, I think we have one of the things that I think has happened is that we have developed a kind of selective memory about the civil rights movement in the 1960s and about how people responded to it. And so I think that one of the things that the debate between Ellison and Arendt, one of the things that it shows is that not everyone responded to the civil rights movement by thinking, oh, these are, you know, heroic, peaceful, respectable protests that we should endorse. Many people saw them as creating confrontations that were unnecessary or were leading to these potentially violent encounters between citizens and the police, and that there were other ways to carry out the struggle. So even though it was, right, a movement based around nonviolence, there were critiqued on various fronts. And I think one of the things that Ellison was trying to say in response to critics like Arendt is that putting your body on the line and exposing yourself to violence because you're trying to defend your rights is a form of heroism. It is a form of, you know, a sacrifice that you are making on behalf of the political community and that it needed to be honored.
Well, what you just alluded to represents part of a critique that you have of a couple myths around the civil rights movement, myths that some people who have criticized the way Black Lives Matter and other protesters have conducted themselves rely on. So one is certainly this notion that, you know, if oppressed people act in an exemplary nonviolent way, members of the dominant racial group, in this case, whites, will be ethically transformed. They'll be spurred to denounce and renounce racial oppression. And you are suggesting, you're indicating that you have a lot of doubt about this, even based on the historical record. Are we returning here to your notion of solidarity and your sense that people of a certain race have a difficult time adopting a kind of empathy and concern for another racial group such that they might be, that their hearts might be moved or changed by, for example, seeing African Americans being beaten in the South in the 60s?
Yeah, I think that this is precisely one of the core arguments that I want to make, which is that I think one of the critiques of the Black Lives Matter movement and the sort of protests against, contemporary protests against police violence has been that they have not behaved right in the kind of exemplary way that the civil rights movement protesters did, and that this is the reason that they haven't garnered the same degree of empathy or of support from the public at large. And one of the things that I think it's important to consider is, A, that we're relying on a false narrative about the civil rights movement, right? So going back to the point I was making earlier, in retrospect, we tend to assume that the civil rights movement was met with immediate support and affirmation. But in fact, right, the civil rights movement, I mean, Martin Luther King was seen as an agitator, right? He was, the people who say that the Black Lives Matter, that some of the organizers, they're professional protesters. He would have been called a professional protester in his time. He was, you know, going from city to city that was experiencing racial strife and organizing people to protest. So I think that we have this notion that nonviolence meant non-confrontation, and I don't think that that's true. I think that what the strategy of the civil rights movement was to bring about a confrontation that would make visible the facts of white supremacy and how it was organized and how it was carried out violently in the South. And so I think that that's one issue, right, is this sort of false narrative that we have in retrospect, this sort of romanticized notion of the civil rights movement. And I think the other important thing to think about is whether what we think happens in those moments, right? When we think that people are confronted with the reality of racial violence, the assumption coming from this narrative about the civil rights movement is that, right, Northern white audiences watching these confrontations unfold, watching these peaceful civil rights protesters in the 60s who were, in some cases, attacked, right, by white police forces, that this led people to renounce racism and to support racial justice. So one of the questions that I raise in the paper is that even if we grant that is what happened, and I have I talk about how that may not have been the case for everyone, and the example that I give there is this example of, again, going back to the essay by Arendt on Reflections on Little Rock, where she is looking at these photographs, right, these iconic photographs of the civil rights movement that appear in newspapers like the New York Times, which show these African-American school children who are being sort of harassed by these enraged white mobs trying to prevent them from entering schools. And what she sees is these children who are being asked to be heroes by their parents who are not there and who don't accompany them, and by the NAACP that's not there. And so she turns it not into a moment where she is, it prompts her to solidarity, but rather into the basis of a critique of why are these children being put on the front lines of these struggles for race or justice. So what I suggest then is partly that these moments of racial confrontation are complicated, and that we can't make assumptions about how they're being received and interpreted by those watching. And I think we see that, for example, today as well, with the videos that have emerged of these incidents of police violence, right? A lot of people say, looking at, for example, the, you know, the videos of for example, Eric Garner getting choked or other of these videos, that how can you see that and not see that the police acted wrongly? But there are people who look at those videos and say, well, why was he resisting? Why didn't he immediately do this? So I think that this assumption that there is a kind of predetermined moral operation that's going to happen as a result is wrong, basically.
Juliet Hooker is her name. She's Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her primary research interests include Black political thought, Latin American political thought, political solidarity, and multiculturalism. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Juliet, who's written a paper about the contemporary Black protest movement that first erupted in Ferguson and reactions to it. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Juliet Hooker is a political theorist based at the University of Texas at Austin. She is the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity, published by Oxford University Press. And I recently saw her present at an American Political Science Association conference, present a paper about Ferguson, Baltimore, Democratic Suffering, and Black Sacrifice. So, Juliet, you were talking about the kind of the romantic narrative of the civil rights movement that a lot of people use in critiquing the way Black Lives Matter activists have conducted themselves at some of the protests following revelations about police violence. Tell us more about this romantic teleological narrative and what trajectory of racial justice it suggests this nation is on.
Yes, I mean, I think that we are at a moment where I guess enough time has passed in terms of the civil rights movement that it has come to be seen in, you know, we have a kind of selective memory of it. So we remember certain parts of it and we don't remember others. And I think the memory of it that has emerged as a sort of dominant official, you know, collective memory is this romanticized narrative that suggests that, you know, the U.S. is on this path of ever increasing racial progress and racial justice, and that it's sort of predetermined to move towards racial equality. And so there are these moments of where you've had racial injustices, but they have been overcome, and they're sort of steps on this predetermined path towards greater equality. We see President Obama has very much relied on this narrative during his presidency when he has, for example, you know, been sworn in on the Bible of the Reverend Martin Luther King, suggesting that, you know, his presidency is the culmination of the struggles of the civil rights movement. And I think one of the ways in which this selective memory operates is that it tends to downplay the more radical aspects of the civil rights movement, right? So, for example, the fact that the March on Washington, what we remember for that, or what's remembered from that, is the, you know, King's I Have a Dream speech rather than the fact that it was a march for jobs and freedom, that it was a march that was intended to protest continuing employment discrimination against African Americans, and also to advocate for passage of the Civil Rights Act, which was at that point stalled in Congress, and that in fact President Kennedy tried to dissuade civil rights leaders from putting on the march. So I think the other side of this narrative, where the sort of more radical or confrontational aspects of the civil rights protesters are forgotten, the other side that's forgotten is the fact that, you know, the political establishment, by and large, didn't embrace the civil rights, the activism of African Americans and the civil rights movement as something that they could get behind, that in fact protest was necessary in order to push policy forward, and that, you know, and that there was backlash against the protest, that they were, that civil rights protesters weren't embraced at the time, that, you know, the idea that MLK would end up being honored with a national holiday would have, I'm sure, been shocking to many people in the 1960s who saw him as this sort of, you know, agitator and that was, you know, tearing the country apart. So I think there's various aspects of selective remembrance around the civil rights movement that then are used to critique contemporary protesters in ways that actually depend on these romanticized narratives of the civil rights movement, right? So saying that Reverend Martin Luther King would have been ashamed of Black Lives Matter protesters is, you know, is absolutely wrong. He would have been marching with them, but this is the way in which that narrative works.
You also write that this romantic narrative of the civil rights movement shifts attention away from Black loss and toward the idea that Black politics should be oriented toward the goal of democratic repair rather than racial justice.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to get at there is the fact that this narrative, right, about these sort of middle class, respectable, well-behaved, nonviolent, heroic Black protesters who put themselves and their bodies on the line in order to achieve greater racial justice, then one of the things that it does is suggest that the way that there is one legitimate form that Black politics should take, right? And it's that form. And it's this form in which Blacks peacefully acquiesce to their losses. And when they protest, right, when they try to bring about change in racist structures, that they need to do so in a nonviolent way that is acceptable, that adheres to the norms of civility, that doesn't sort of offend white sensibilities, that they're not allowed to express, for example, rage, which is in some ways a very normal response to violence and to terror and to injustice, right? There's something absolutely normal and healthy about being angry at injustice. But that sort of range of human emotion is precluded by this mythical idea that what Black citizens should do is be these kind of superhuman figures who acquiesce peacefully, who put their bodies on the line, who enact this form of political heroism, and who in so doing are sacrificing themselves on behalf of the common good, right? Because what they're achieving is this greater good of more racially egalitarian society. But I think one of the things that I think is important to think about is whether, in fact, that shifts attention away from the kind of disparities and injustices that prompt Black protest in the first place, and on to this question of, well, how do we preserve peaceful, stable democracy rather than how do we address the injustices that cause people to protest in the first place?
Well, if some of this discussion and some of your conclusions hinges on the question of whether white people are moved by nonviolent protest on the part of African Americans, It's useful to bring up, and you do in this paper, the ideas of the political theorist Joel Olson. What did he observe about the impact of the fact that whites as a group have historically been the winners in U.S. democracy? They've historically been the winners. The impact of that on whites' political imagination.
Yes, I think one of the things that Olson suggests, which I think is very important, is that the political imagination of white citizens has not been shaped by loss. And what that means is that they, he argues, have therefore developed a what he calls a limited political imagination, so that their notion of citizenship is less about participation and more about standing, so that being a citizen becomes not about being, you know, an equal participant in a kind of democratic political community, but rather about having greater standing vis-a-vis other groups. And what this means is that, therefore, the extent to which they can identify with the political community and to which they feel like, you know, their rights as citizens are being protected has to do with the extent to which they have greater rights than others or greater privileges, and to which their concerns remain central in policy debates. And this sort of creates the, you know, some of the problems that we're seeing today. When you look at, for example, the reactions against immigrants or the kind of xenophobic policies that are being discussed against refugees, and sort of the rhetoric around things like who the real Americans are, and you know, the claim that certain people aren't real Americans, it's about this sense that, right, and about, you know, these slogans about reclaiming her country or something like that, that really being a citizen isn't, for people who feel this way, isn't about, you know, being part of a diverse political community, but it's about the centering of people who are like them and their preferences and vision of the United States as the privileged narrative of the country.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Juliet Hooker joins me. She's a political theorist based at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's the author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity. We have a link to that book and to her faculty page at UT Austin on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, if, as you seem to be suggesting, African Americans are expected to be, in a sense, good losers by practicing the politics of respectability and nonviolence and to some degree acquiescence, although, you know, as you've said, nonviolent protest does not equal acquiescence, then it is instructive to look at whether whites in U.S. society have been good losers, have been the kind of losers that they expect, in your opinion, blacks to be. And you go back to the 1960s when, you know, at least some of the privileges, the racial privileges of whites were undermined or eliminated. You go back and look at whether whites could or should be considered good losers at that time. What do you conclude?
So I conclude that they were not good losers. They have not been good losers. And the basis for this actually is a very discernible pattern in U.S. politics, where moments of, you know, victories for greater racial equality have been followed by these periods of backlash and retrenchment, where rights that have been gained have slowly been eroded. We see this with the Civil War, right, which leads to the end of slavery and is followed by Reconstruction and the attempt to enfranchise African American men, which is then followed by the post-Reconstruction period of disenfranchisement, the, you know, establishing of racial segregation and Jim Crow, and of, you know, sort of white supremacy as a, you know, official ideology of the country. And if you look at the 1960s, I think what we see is a similar pattern, right? The victories of the civil rights movement, which were, you know, of course, quite important and made enormous changes to U.S. society, were followed by, I think, a period where they were slowly, some of those gains have slowly been eroded. If you look at today, the dismantling of things like the Voting Rights Act or the placing barriers to minority voter registration, things of that sort, I think we see that some of the policies that were put in place in the 60s are being dismantled and were followed by this period, I think, of racial resentment. I think we see this even with the election of Obama in 2008, which I think a lot of people thought would lead to this moment of greater, right, sort of post-racial moment in the United States where people had finally elected a non-white president and it would lead to greater racial harmony. And I think instead what we've seen is a period of backlash, certainly right now in the presidential race, of sort of growing xenophobia and anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti, you know, sort of very openly racist discourse on the part of some of the candidates that is quite troubling. And I think clearly points to the fact that we, you know, that idea that we were having this post-racial moment certainly didn't happen. And I think this is clearly a response to this issue of democratic loss, right? That I think many, unfortunately, I think many whites saw this as loss and see, right, the election of an African-American or the, you know, the greater political participation of Latinos, they see this as threats that threaten their interests. And I think that leads to these the sense of sort of white victimhood, where, you know, you have these sort of narratives about how the country is being taken over, or these fears about minorities that show that, you know, the kind of acceptance of loss, right? The acceptance of, you know, no, not every president will always be white, which has been the norm, is not something that is, which white citizens have had to cope. They never had to cope with it, right, before Obama.
So, Juliet, if you're not in agreement with the thinker Danielle Allen about, you know, she's saying that people who are losers in democracy have to cope with the experience of loss in an exemplary fashion, if you're not in agreement with Ralph Ellison, who speaks of a, you know, a special duty to act within the rule of law and act heroically and, you know, sacrifice the need for revenge, if you feel like nonviolent protests during the 1960s did not in fact shame a lot of whites into coming around to the project of racial justice or at least agreeing with it, then what kind of politics are you suggesting? What kinds of politics are you advocating for those people who are justifiably outraged by police brutality and police violence?
So I think what I'm trying to suggest is that to expect Black citizens who are the ones who are experiencing this defining moment of racial terror to further sacrifice by being the ones responsible for the work of repairing the wrongs of racial justice is to add another sacrifice to those who are already sacrificing, right? To add another loss to those who are already experiencing losses. So what I'm suggesting is that the burden of, you know, dismantling white supremacy shouldn't rest solely or primarily with those who are experiencing, for example, police violence. I also want to suggest that I think that Black politics should be oriented towards making visible the harms that are being suffered, that African Americans are suffering. And so that instead of it necessarily being oriented only at, right, sort of repairing, you know, following these norms of civility so that it can garner white sympathy, that it should be concerned with expressing anger at injustice, with trying to make visible those wrongs. And I think that this is a different orientation, because I think that it means that instead of being concerned with how do you present your demands in such a way that you might elicit white sympathy, it's about protesting injustice. And if white sympathy follows, then that's great. But that Black politics shouldn't be oriented towards this idea of democratic sacrifice, because I think it moves the focus away from the problems of racial injustice onto how do we engage in sort of these civil debates about, you know, repairing U.S. democracy, rather than focusing on how to overcome racial injustice. And I think we see this a bit in the debates about the student protests on campus, where people have, you know, where they shift away from the problems that students are bringing to light around, you know, what does it mean to bring Black and brown bodies on campus and yet not do anything to change a kind of hostile racial climate. And then the debate shifts to focus on how they're going about making those protests, and whether they're, you know, violating others' rights to, or trying to limit other people's rights to free speech, so that the focus moves away from, right, the issue of the racial climate on campus to the question of free speech. And that's, I want to suggest that there's a similar dynamic that happens with when we think about Black politics as being oriented towards repairing the bonds of democracy. I also want to suggest that I think that there is something fruitful about rejecting this narrative of Black politics being oriented towards this heroic form of, you know, sort of respectable, nonviolent, acceptable protest. Because I think, you know, when you look at, for example, one of the claims of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is this idea that all Black lives matter, right? Which means in part rejecting this distinction between law-abiding, middle-class, respectable Black folks and then these, you know, sort of criminal Black thugs who deserve whatever happens to them, that making that claim that all Black lives matter, I think, makes an important intervention in rejecting this kind of logic of the carceral state, right? That some people don't deserve to have their rights respected because they're already criminals or because they're soon to be criminals.
Well, when African-American protests, recent ones, have moved in a kind of non-respectable, uncivil direction, they are often characterized as riots. And I think sympathizers of these African-American protesters would maybe call them uprisings. So, you know, on a concrete level, what is your sense of whether riots or uprisings or whatever you want to call them, whether they can be productive and whether they ought to be pursued if, you know, considered appropriate by the people at these events?
What I want to suggest is that we need to stop and think about, you know, what is it legitimate to ask people whose lives have been defined by mass incarceration, by state policy that has confined them in many cases by design to urban ghettos that don't have the same kind of state services or educational opportunities that are defined by, you know, sometimes predatory local governments that use fines and traffic tickets and other means to fund themselves via, you know, sort of these forms of taxation of those who are already poor. What is it legitimate for us as a democracy to ask those citizens to sacrifice, right, who are already sacrificing, is it legitimate to ask them then to express their anger at injustice in these ways that we see as more productive or more, you know, more civil? So I think I would switch that question around to say, you know, what can we ask of them when they are already sacrificing? And I think what I want to suggest is that when we look at these moments when violent confrontations have erupted that, you know, that have been described as riots, one of the things that I suggest in the paper is that maybe we should consider whether that these, you know, riots are a form of democratic repair. And what I mean by that is that they're not constructive in the sense of they are not necessarily going to solve the sort of structural problems that lead to, you know, mass incarceration or, you know, police violence in the first place, but that they are maybe productive in the sense that they allow Blacks and the communities that are being affected by these problems to express their anger at these injustices, to make them visible in a way that they're otherwise not allowed, because this is beyond the norms of you know, sort of acceptable democratic politics. And I think, you know, one of the things that I point to is this idea that, you know, the law, you know, and obeying the law and the letter of the law is not always the way to achieve justice, because sometimes the law is unjust. If you look at slavery, right, abolitionists and fugitive slaves committed crimes by stealing, quote unquote, stealing themselves, right, in order to escape enslavement. So that I think there's a tradition in Black political thought where you have to sometimes make a distinction between, you know, that the law and what is legal might in fact be unjust, and that therefore struggles for racial justice and Black freedom might require having a different relationship to the law.
Juliet Hooker, Associate Professor of Government and of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, author of Race and the Politics of Solidarity. Juliet, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.